Voilà, bonjour à tous et à toutes. My name is Jean Lapremont, Sciences Po School of Law and University of Manchester. My role this morning is to chair this first panel, to enforce the time, and also to offer a first round of comments on the four very promising papers that will be presented by our four distinguished speakers. Speaking of whom, I think they don't need any introduction. I will simply list them in the order in which they will present their paper. We'll start with Professor Alain Pellet from the University of Paris-Nanterre. Professor David Lefkowitz from Richmond University will follow up. Professor Christian Tams from the University of Glasgow will, after the break, have the chance to present his thoughts. And then Professor Catherine Brunman from the University of Amsterdam will conclude this rich morning. Taken together, these four contributions, I believe, wonderfully set the stage for our discussion today and tomorrow. Let me say that these are four papers that are extremely solid in conceptual and theoretical terms, and we couldn't hope for a better start. Each speaker, as you understood, will have 30 minutes to develop her or his claims. I think 30 minutes is already very, very generous and surely more than enough, so please stick to the time allocated to you, and I'm afraid I'll be ruthless and I'll cut you short. At this stage, we are running with a delay of 6 minutes, but as they say in planes and train, we'll try to make up for that. So without further ado, I'll give the floor to Professor Pellet. I believe you can use a lectern if you wish.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, dear colleagues. Well, let me start with a quote. When there is no suffering or coercion, it is well known that there is no rape. Lorsqu'il n'y a ni souffrance ni contrainte, c'est bien connu, il n'y a pas de viol. This is the one of the key sentences of the fascinating and terrifying chronicle, not sure how you translate récit in English, of the chronicle by Vanessa Springora, Le Consentement, Consenting. The author didn't want, but she had no will to have sex with the, in her eyes, great writer Gabriel Matzneff at the age of 14. However, she consented to it out of fascination, under influence. Of course, the comparison might look a bit daring, but that is what I have in mind when, as in this little title, the title of this presentation, I assert that in international law too, consenting is not willing. To say that a norm of is legal because it expresses the will of the one, of the state, I will limit myself to states, the one that is bound is, I think, a short-sighted postulate that explains nothing at all, and even if it were correct, it would only concern a part of what is legal, because legal norms cannot be limited to what is binding. This corresponds to the intuitions I had in the origin of an old paper that appeared in the Australian Yearbook of International Law in 1992 until the title The Normative Dilemma, Will and Consent in International Lawmaking. And in fact, it was written, I think the colloquium in Canberra was something like 1989. Well, of course, this paper has aged, but I must immodestly and stubbornly confess that on the whole, I still adhere with the essence of what I wrote in this paper. My strong maintained view is that the so-called voluntarism, the for me the only positivism in the etymological sense of the word, voluntarism overlooks the objective reality and refuses to look at the reality behind the legal formation, then depriving voluntarists, I think, deprives themselves of any possibility of understanding the rule of law. And although I do not see myself at all as a good legal theorist, I think this is quite important, since legal theories are not, at least not only, innocuous intellectual games. They have concrete consequences and may become both political stakes and tools. It seems, in order nowadays to apologize for being mainstream. In some respect, I am not. I am critical, but not on the general approach of international law, and at the risk of sounding like an old crank, which I admittedly I am, I remain convinced that the most important theoretical problem and the one of the greatest practical and political importance is that of the foundation of public international law. What makes it law? I.e., what makes it a system of norms, of behavior, that the addressees consider as such? And to make things worse concerning my positions, I also maintain two important beliefs, which explain what I will try to develop this morning. First, the only theories that have a real explanatory value are voluntarism, to which I do not adhere, and sociological objectivism, to which I do adhere, but not in its Sealian and moralist or moralizing version, rather in a so-called Marxian and maybe outmoded perspective. Second, worse still, I persist in thinking that the venerable notion of the sources of law, defined as a legal process creating general norms intending to govern international relations, retains an irreplaceable explanatory virtue, both with regard to norms creating to norms creating binding obligations, and to norms recommending or encouraging particular conducts. Thus defined, the concept of sources of law is a method to evaluate the acceptability of a rule within a given circle. It is the test through which you can determine whether a political project or wish has penetrated into the legal sphere. In my last century's article, I had made much of the distinction between consent and will. I still value the distinction between both words or both notions, and I still consider that it was and is appropriate to differentiate between will and consent. But on reflection, what is more important than these two words probably is whether the will or the consent at stake are free or not. However, in an attempt to clarify, I will use will to designate an affirmative attitude. I want this. This is my will. And I would add, this is what I really want. That's will. It has a psychological and subjective component. Consent, from my point of view, is different. It implies, or may imply, something more passive and includes resignation, discouragement, even dismay, as in Vanessa Springora's book. And notwithstanding these aspects, it does concern, it does at least may produce legal effects upon legally rather well-defined conditions. Although the shade in meaning of both words might not be as clear in English than in French, concern can be valid even if it expresses a reluctant will. The point here is that states do not want a particular rule of law, but even if their will is not free, they will consent, and they will, in most cases, validly consent to that rule, not because they want it, but because they have no real choice. Yet the distinction is rarely done. Thus, in the 1969 Vienna Convention on the Law of Treaties, the convention uses the word consent 62 times, but what the drafters had in mind clearly was to promote and to preserve as much as possible a valid consent expressing as much as possible the real will of the states. However, the reverse is nearly as usual, and will, or more often in French, volonté, is used instead of consent, including for describing the rules in the Vienna Convention. Yet, as the ICJ rightly noted in the genocide, the Croatian case, and I quote, there is a distinction between the legal nature of ratification or accession to a treaty on the one hand, and on the other, the process by which a state becomes bound by a treaty as a successor state or remains bound as a continuing state. In the first state, say ratification, there is still, the court still says, there is a simple act of will on the part of the state manifesting an intention to become a party. In the case of succession or continuation, on the other hand, the act of will of the state relates to an already existing set of circumstances and amounts to a recognition by that state of certain legal consequences flowing from these circumstances, so that any document issued by the state concerned, being essentially confirmatory, may be subject to less rigid requirements of form. End of quote. Strictly speaking, and even though the court mentions an act of will in both cases, consent would more properly mark a less clearly affirmed will. Even though consent itself is not a univocal concept, or maybe more exactly the manifestations of consent in the international legal spheres are quite diverse, the difference between both notions is more effectively represented on a scale than by determining a threshold. To make it short, unilateral acts of the state are probably the epitome of consent, at least when they aim at imposing obligation to their own author. Then come treaty obligations, of which party is consent forms the basis. Please note, consent and not will. Consentement, not volonté. But whatever the role of state will in treaty making, where consent is predominant, it is clear that its influence is even less important regarding the means of formation of the other means of formation of legal rules, starting, of course, with customary obligations that Prosper Veil, the most rigorous advocate of voluntarism in the last century, has defined as the Achilles heel of consensualist outlook. And indeed it is. And the voluntarist so-called explanation that customary obligations lie on a tacit agreement is a totally misleading fable. Just to give an example, new states find them in their birth crib together with their sovereignty. Indeed, only persistent objectors are not bound by those rules, but all other states are. And I think the persistent objector doctrine is at best a contracting out doctrine, which is largely unrealistic because in most cases states do not care. Practice develops without them being aware of the process, and when they awake, awake is à la mode, when they awake, that is when the time of opinio iuris has arrived, it is too late. The evil has been done and the rule does exist. More generally, as the ILC noted in its commentaries of its draft conclusions on identification of customary international law, the usual Latin terms, opinio iuris, well captures, and I quote, the particular nature of the indispensable subjective element of customary international law as referring to legal conviction and not to a formal consent. The most which can be said is that state will contribute very, very, very little to the formation of customary rules, while some form of soft consent may be presumed. Now, general principles of law, for their part, those mentioned in Article 38.1c of the ICJ statute, represent the degree zero in state consent. These principles are deduced from domestic laws whose rules have been elaborated without any intent as to their role as a source of obligation in international law. This has nothing to do with state will at the international level. And yet, according to both dominant doctrine and the international case law, all these sources are equal. Well, equal in dignity, maybe, but concretely things are different. The intensity of recourse to one or the other of the sources I have mentioned, I have confined myself for the moment to the Article 38 sources, the intensity of recourse to those rules is quite proportional to the constant load in each source. No doubt the preference given to written law is in part dictated by practical convenience. However, this is not the only reason. The intensity of consent and consequently of legitimacy impregnating the respective obligation also plays a role in this preference. Now, it would be erroneous to draw a voluntarist conclusion from this customary obligations are not less binding, legally speaking, than treaty obligation. Simply, handling customary norms is more difficult and their acceptability is lower. Now, whatever the location within this scale, of a source within this scale, what is crucial from my point of view is that it is not enough to will. It is also necessary to be able to will. And it is obvious that the will of small and weak states is less free than that of wealthy, powerful states. Yet this certainly does not prevent them, the weak states, to validly express their consent to be bound by treaties and to participate, volens nolens, to the formation of customary rules. This all in the name of the principle of sovereignty, which must be recognized as having some virtues, but clearly is hypocritical in being indissociable from equality. Indeed, no state, even the most powerful ones, can, for various reasons, express an entirely free will in that, except maybe Putin's Russia. All must take into account external constraints. But of course, in the words of Jean de La Fontaine, depending on whether you are powerful or powerless, selon que vous serez puissant ou misérable, it will be easier both to get a favorable bargain and to get out of the legal chains thus accepted. That said, there can be no doubt that consent is not incompatible with at least a certain amount of coercion. It must be accepted that coercion, lato sensu, is a component of international society as of any society. But this does not impede states in validly consenting to rules of and obligations under international law. I will omit some developments because I see time is passing. Whatever the conditions for a valid consent, when they express their consent in conformity with the rules of treaty or the rule of sources, I think that states buy a one-way ticket. By its consent, whether it corresponds to its real will or not, the state must abide. Pacta sunt servanda. But the formula is very ambiguous, and this sacrosanct slogan of voluntarism, means in reality the very contrary to voluntarism. Whatever its will, this is not voluntarist, whatever its will, a state must abide by the law it entered into. And this idea of a trap for will is conveyed, for example, in the recent judgment in preliminary objections in the case of Guyana versus Venezuela. It would therefore seem that consent is only an explanation for one part of the process, the access to the treaty. It does not explain the basis of a state's obligation when that state is no longer willing to implement a treaty. And in this respect, I joined Samantha Besson, who rightly drew attention in her recent article in the Ladle Journal on the importance of disagreement. Indeed, as also stressed by Philippe Allot, I think you quote him too, a treaty is not the end of a process, but the beginning of another process. But I suggest that there is no symmetry between the two processes. When it enters an agreement, a state acts unilaterally, even though the means of expressing consent to be bound show an increasing flexibility in the conclusion of treaties today. But for their parts, the rules on withdrawal demonstrate an increase or more formal rigidity, notably with the pressure of the treaty bodies, which are jealously guarding the integrity of the treaty and of its membership. Of course, the law of treaties offers an apparent safety net to states in the form of the famous doctrine of the fundamental changes of circumstances. It is a well-established rule of law, but it puzzles voluntarist doctrine, and it is indeed not easy to reconcile that with the idea of will and the idea of a clausula, inexistent clausula rebus sic stantibus, is for me totally absurd. In fact, this rule, fundamental change of circumstances, which does exist in all systems of law, is maybe except very primitive one, those who are immobile, is rooted in the necessities of social life. The function of legal rules is to meet social needs. When social needs change, legal rules lose legitimacy and lose their binding force. In the prevailing conditions of modern international law, a formal expression of consent is not even necessary. Customary law, but also the rules embodied in the so-called codification treaties, or even traité loi, which more often than not are progressive development treaties, not far from that codification treaties, can nevertheless be or becoming binding and recognized as such upon all states, even when they are not in force. There is more, of course, use cogens. I think there is no need to enter in any detail in the trite discussion about the role of consent in its formation. Clearly, each state does not have to consent to use cogens. Its function is to avoid a kind of the necessity of unanimous consensus. This is well known, I jump to. What is true is that there is some consensualist dimension in jus cogens, but the consent of the community of state as a whole, which is very different from an addition of wills by many states. It is, in fact, what characterizes jus cogens is a reinforced opinio iuris. An opinio iuris which first says it is law, second says but it is superior law. So double degrees consent, but global consent. I would go further. The role of opinio iuris is not confined to custom or jus cogens. It is, from my point of view, an indispensable test applying to all obligations. I would go even further. It is the very criterion of law which differentiates law from ethics or religion, even more so from political sciences or economic so-called laws. Opinio iuris and consent are different notions. In many cases, you may feel legally bound, even if consent is very remote. Willy-nilly, you accept that through the legal system, obligations can be imposed upon you. Now, it goes without saying that the effectiveness of the obligations can be imposed The effectiveness of the obligation can be imposed to you. I have lost my passage. The effectiveness of the obligation will be enhanced if the addressee has consented to it. By consenting to the obligations, the obligation becomes subjectively legitimate, and legitimacy clearly is a relative guarantee of increased effectiveness. And I expect I cannot detail here, but which is developed more in my written contribution, and probably will be discussed by Professor Lefkovich in a minute. Before ceding him the floor, let me only add one remark. Consent has another virtue. It can be given to a non-binding norm. In such a case, it expresses an intention. It fixes a target without creating strict obligations to act for the addressee. Contemporary international law is replete with such instruments, foremost among them the recommendations of the collective bodies of international organizations, which lack the capacity, usually, to impose obligations or prohibitions on their addresses, but which nevertheless seek to influence the conduct of those addressees and do not necessarily fail to do so any more than treaties. This was magnificently explained by Sir Harsh Lauterpacht in the separate opinion attached to the ICJ advisory opinion of 1955 in one of the many cases concerning South West Africa, which all students in international law should be not recommended to read, but compelled, obliged, bound to read and reflect on. In these cases of so-called soft law, collective consent is at the origin of flexible norms intended to guide the conduct of the addressees, mainly the members of the organizations adopting those norms, without imposing binding obligations. As the ICJ rightly stressed in its judgment of 2018 on the obligation to negotiate, a state's, quote, participation in the consensus for adopting some resolution does not imply that it has accepted to be bound under international law by the content of these resolutions, end of quote. Nevertheless, like the ratification of a treaty or the adoption of a unilateral commitment, a vote in the United Nations General Assembly or the Security Council or any other organ of an international organization expresses some form of consent of the state that cast it. What the state expresses is consent, but not necessarily a commitment or will, neither on the content of the resolution nor of the its binding force. Thus, just to last sentence to conclude, consent irrigates the great shades of nuances that permeate international, and it contributes to the famous infinite variety of international law, but definitely, ladies and gentlemen, consenting is not willing. Thank you.